Welcome to your weekly constitutional radio show about the Constitution, produced in partnership with the home of the Constitution, James Madison's Montpelier. My name is Stuart Harris, and I teach constitutional law at the Appalachian School of Law in beautiful Grundy, Virginia. And I'm speaking to you today from the studios of WETS-FM at HD1 in Johnson City, Tennessee. Our subject today is death. Our subject, that's a good subject, isn't it? Yeah, it seems to pop up with frequency on this show. Our subject is punishment. Our subject is specifically the death penalty, and even more specifically, a case that originated right here in Northeast Tennessee, specifically in Union County, just north of Knoxville, in a little tiny town of Luttrell. You may have heard of this case. If you live in this area, it was called House versus Bell. Ringing any bells? Sorry, couldn't resist. I recently spoke to an unlikely person about this case. He was actually a law professor from California. He's very prominent in constitutional law circles. His name is Peter Irons. I happened to run into Peter when I was out at Montpelier working with them on a different project entirely. And when I asked Peter if he'd sit down with me and talk to me about his most recent book, I was very surprised to find myself, figuratively at least, back in Northeast Tennessee. The name of the book is The Steps to the Supreme Court, and it is a book where Peter takes you from the beginning of a case all the way up the steps it has to go through to reach the Supreme Court, then through the Supreme Court proceedings, and then what happens to the case after the Supreme Court renders its decision. And in his book, as he explains, Peter took two different cases, one civil case, which we'll talk about in a later episode, and one criminal case. And it's the criminal case that we're going to talk about today. House versus Bell, again, is the name of the case. And it involved a rape and a murder and a body of a poor woman who was found in a ditch after a day or two of searching for her. And what happened after that point? And it's a long and sordid tale, and maybe there was some corruption involved from government officials. You can decide that for yourself. And it went all the way to the Supreme Court and right back here to Northeast Tennessee. So without further ado, let's talk to Professor Peter Irons.
But the case I picked for this book is very interesting. It's called House versus Bell, decided by the Supreme Court in 2006. Mm-hmm. But the case started in 1985 in a rural county in Tennessee, eastern Tennessee, Union County, a very small town, Luttrell, Tennessee. And June 13th, 1985, a woman went missing from her home, young woman, 29 years old, Carolyn Muncy. And she had two children, a girl named Laura, who was 10, and a son named Matthew, who was 8 at the time. Now, she went missing from her home sometime between 9 and 11 p.m. that night. It was a Saturday night, very hot. And her husband, known as Little Hube, his name was Hubert Muncy, called the sheriff, said his wife was missing. The sheriff came over. They looked around the area. It was a house with no running water, no indoor plumbing, no telephone. And it was dark, of course. And they didn't find her anywhere around the house. And Little Hube said he thought his wife had been kidnapped. But they were living in dire poverty. Why anyone would kidnap her?
Yeah, that's a strange thing. Okay.
So at any rate, the next afternoon, Sunday afternoon, one of their neighbors lived about 2 miles away, a man named Paul House, Paul Gregory House, came over to help look for Carolyn and met up with a guy who was one of Carolyn's cousins who was also looking for her. And they both went off to find more people to help with the search. And the cousin, his name was Billy Ray Hensley, decided that there was something strange about Paul House, why he was showing up there, and went back with a friend of his to the scene. The road, a very rural road, that goes by the Muncie's house, which was up on a hill. And they walked along the embankment there. There's a creek at the bottom. And they discovered her body.
Oh, boy.
Covered with some brush and some leaves, but still visible. And discovered that, called the sheriff, and discovered that she had been beaten. She had died of blows to her head. She hadn't been shot or stabbed or strangled. She'd been suffered a cerebral hemorrhage, they found out during the autopsy. And the sheriff became suspicious of Paul House because Billy Ray Hensley said when he was driving down the first time to see if little Hugh was home, he noticed Paul House coming up from the embankment across the road, wiping his hands on what he said was a black rag.
Yeah.
And so the sheriff asked House if he would come in for an interview, which he did. And he denied having anything to do with this. But the sheriff knew that House was on parole from a conviction in Utah when he was 18 years old for aggravated sexual battery.
Oh, boy.
And he'd been paroled to his mother's place in Tennessee. And he'd only been there for 3 or 4 months. And the sheriff asked a very unusual question of House. He said, are those the pants? He was wearing jeans. Are those the jeans you were wearing yesterday? And House said, yes, they are. Well, the sheriff, for some reason, sent a investigator over to the trailer in which House was living with his girlfriend, Donna Turner. And the deputy went through the laundry hamper and discovered at the bottom a pair of jeans on which he thought were spots of blood, reddish-brown spots of blood, fairly small, but across the cuff and the legs of the jeans. Mm-hmm. So he took those and sent them off.
I have to interrupt here. Did he have a warrant at that point? I mean,
he had consent.
He had consent, okay. He asked the wife?
Right. It wasn't his wife. It was his girlfriend. But she could give consent for the search.
Right.
And at any rate, along with the clothes that Carolyn Muncie had been wearing when she was discovered, which was a nightgown, a pair of panties, a bra, and a night jacket, and 4 vials of her blood that had been taken during the autopsy. And the deputy sheriff packed them all in a cardboard box, and along with House's jeans, and drove from Union County to Washington, D.C., to the FBI lab, and turned them over to a lab technician.
Wait a minute. The sheriff himself put all the stuff in his car.
The deputy did.
And drove it all, physically drove it all the way to Washington, D.C.
All the way to Washington, D.C. Now, it was like 90 degrees at the time.
Right.
There was no refrigeration in the box. The vials of blood were in a little styrofoam cooler kind of thing. And it was later testified that they were getting bounced up and down and also overheated. And they were not properly sealed. The vials of blood just had plastic stoppers stuck in them. There was no tape. There was no paraffin around them, which is standard procedure. And so he turned them over to the FBI technician, who discovered and later testified that there was a 93% chance that the blood on the jeans matched Carolyn Muncie's blood.
Now, this, again, is 1985.
This is 1985.
Okay, so the technology, the DNA testing, then was not nearly so advanced
That's
as it
right.
is now. Okay. Just
In fact, it was 2 years later, 1987, when American courts first accepted DNA evidence.
Okay, so this is the dark ages, really, in terms of forensics.
Right.
Okay, just wanted to make clear of that.
So on the basis of Billy Ray Hensley's allegation that he had seen House at the scene of the murder, not committing it, but the day after, and that the blood was Carolyn Muncie's blood on his jeans. He was arrested, indicted for capital murder. The allegation, capital murder requires what are called special circumstances, particularly aggravated murders, murders of more than one person, murders of police officers or other public officials, not just your ordinary barroom murder.
Right, this was garden variety murder because there'd been a lot of violence. Right.
Well,
was there also a rape involved?
There was an alleged rape because there was semen. The technician found semen on Carolyn's panties and her nightgown. And it was the same blood type that Paul House had, type A blood. Later turned out that this was highly in dispute. For example, 36% of all males would have had the A blood type.
What about her husband? What was his type?
They didn't test him.
They didn't test her husband?
And the husband, little Hugh Muncie, was well known in the community as a wife abuser, and he'd been arrested 19 times for public drunkenness, and he'd been arrested for assaulting police officers.
Oh, boy.
But he was a friend of the sheriff, and he said that he had spent the previous night until midnight at a square dance at the local community center.
I just want to get this clear. The sheriff is a good buddy of a guy who's been arrested 19 times, including for assaulting police officers.
Right.
I'm sorry. That just strikes me as rather odd to begin with.
It is odd. But, you know, it's more likely than not, as you probably know, Stuart, that in most domestic violence cases, including murders, it's either the husband or the wife who is the perpetrator.
Yeah, most victims know their
assailants. That's right.
Yeah.
Paul House had actually barely known the Muncies. He'd been to their house two or three times, but they were not close friends. But it was alleged that he had gone over there to rape her, lure her out of her house, and rape her. And when she had resisted, he had smacked her in the head with his fist, and she died of a cerebral hemorrhage. So he was indicted. He was tried in February of 1986. The jury took exactly 1 hour to convict him, and another hour to in a what's called a sentencing hearing to sentence him to death.
Wow. Okay, I just want to get this clear now. There are really, I mean, if you look at it objectively, at least two suspects here. One of them's the husband with this checkered past and this history of assaults domestically as well as on police officers, right? Drunkenness.
He had never been charged with assaulting his wife.
Okay, he had not been charged with that, but he had been charged with assaults.
Because his wife, in fact, although friends and neighbors noticed that she was often bruised and had split lips, always said that, well, she walked into a door or tripped on something.
Okay, so there is some evidence, even though there's never been a charge of domestic abuse.
Right.
That's suspect number one. Suspect number two is a guy who also has a checkered past. And in fact, he has a history of sexual assault, so you have to acknowledge that. But he's the out-of-town guy.
That's right. He's the stranger.
Okay, it's starting to sound like he got hometowned here.
That's exactly right. And at any rate...
So 1 hour to convict, 1 hour to sentence to death.
Right.
Okay.
So after he was sent off to the maximum security prison in Tennessee, where there were about 100 other people on death row, he started filing appeals in the state courts. And he was turned away by every level of the state courts up to the state Supreme Court.
You say he, now was he represented or was he doing this on his own?
At first he was represented by court-appointed attorneys. Now he had an attorney at the trial whom his mother had hired. But this guy, and he'd tried murder cases before, but the complete record, I have the transcripts of the entire proceeding, both the trial and the sentencing hearing. It's pretty clear that he did a rather lackluster job. Mm-hmm. He did not put Paul House on the stand for the obvious reason that the prosecutor would have brought out his previous rape conviction, although that conviction itself was rather suspect. But at any rate, he started filing appeals. And after he'd been turned down, and this took several years, by all of the Tennessee courts, the trial court, the Court of Criminal Appeals, the Supreme Court, he filed a habeas corpus petition in federal court.
Now, let's just clarify. Now, you've got a right to appeal anytime you're convicted of a crime, and most crimes are state crimes, since you're mostly in state court, and you take it all the way up to your state Supreme Court, and you exhaust those remedies. And then this thing you call habeas corpus is what we sometimes call a collateral attack on the conviction. That means you come at it from a different angle. Habeas corpus is the so-called ancient writ. It goes all the way at least back to the Magna Carta in 1215. And the idea there is that you go to a federal judge and you say, "Judge, they didn't treat me right in the state court system." And the judge, if he agrees with you, at least preliminarily, will issue this writ, and it means literally produce the body. You're holding a prisoner, bring him before me, and now state court system, justify to me, the federal judge, why you are holding this person.
Exactly.
Okay, good. So that's where we are now. We're in federal court in a habeas petition, which is frequently one of the last resorts of the defense counsel.
It is the last resort, yeah. And the vast majority of habeas petitions are denied. Prisoners will use anything they can.
Of course, especially if in a capital case, they're going to pull out the stops.
And the case was assigned to a federal judge in Knoxville, Judge John Jarvis, mm-hmm. who held a 3-day evidentiary hearing. Now, here's where the case gets really interesting, Stuart, because...
Oh, you mean it's not interesting so far?
Well, it gets more...
I think it's pretty interesting so far.
Gets more interesting.
Yeah. More interesting, okay.
There is a... In every judicial district in the country, there's what's called a federal defender's office. And these are lawyers who represent defendants, usually indigent defendants in criminal cases.
This is the federal equivalent of the public defender in a state court.
That's right.
Got it.
And Paul House wound up with absolutely the most fantastic federal defender he could possibly get. A guy named Steve Kissinger.
Mm-hmm.
And what Kissinger did, with help from a friend of his who was an experienced criminal lawyer, Kissinger only handles capital cases.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's really an expert on this. He and an investigator re-examined the case, went back to Luttrell, Tennessee, interviewed all the previous witnesses, and discovered that there were a number of witnesses that the original trial lawyer had not called to testify, who had very incriminating evidence against little Hugh Muncy.
Yeah, geez Louise, Peter, now, this is bringing up something that's a whole nother subject, if you will, and that is the relative level of competency, or I should say incompetency, of so many of these lawyers that try these capital cases, defend these capital cases. Now, I realize capital cases don't come up every day. It's a specialized area, but it you hear this again and again and again, that they appoint some fellow or somebody gets hired by somebody's mom, and they go in there and they just screw up. Is that sounding like that's what this poor fellow did? I mean, yeah. I don't know the man, and I don't mean to cast aspersions, but wow, this is serious stuff.
Yeah, unfortunately, this happens in most jurisdictions. Yeah. There's only one state, California, where I live, that actually requires lawyers in capital cases to have special training and certification.
Well, there's an idea.
In a lot of states, for example, Texas is the worst example in capital punishment across the board. The number of people convicted, the number of people executed, the number of probably innocent people who've been executed. Mm. And in Texas, a judge can appoint any lawyer, no special training required. And they pay them a pittance. It used to be $1,000. I think it's gone up now to $10,000. But they don't get any additional funds for investigation, for forensic investigation.
Wow.
And so consequently, the most common allegation in a habeas petition in a capital case is what's called ineffective assistance of counsel.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking with Professor Peter Irons about a death penalty case from right here in northeast Tennessee, from the tiny town of Luttrell, Tennessee. And he's just been talking to me about a very important constitutional concept called ineffective assistance of counsel. We'll talk more with Professor Peter Irons right after we have a break and our constitutional quiz. Stay tuned.
I was walking down the street minding my own affair when two policemen grabbed me unaware. They says, "Your name Henry." I says, "Why, sure." Says you the boy I've been looking for. I was blame. I was blame.
Blame. Well, it's time to concentrate. It's time to draw the drapes. Turn out the lights. Draw near to the glow of the radio dial. Get your pen and paper and get ready for the constitutional quiz. Kelly, our quiz lady, is here, and she is going to quiz you. Right, Kelly?
I am here. Who do we have? Who's our victim today?
You have Joe Crook.
Joe, where are you from?
I'm from Tallahassee.
From Tallahassee? Are you a Seminole?
I am.
You are a Florida State Seminole. Well, can you do the war chant for us? No? Next time you're on, Joe, if you call back again, you have to be ready to do that for us.
I do it a little bit better with 80,000 of my closest friends.
80,000 of your closest friends and perhaps a few beers to get you lubricated. All right. Well, do you have a hard question for Joe today?
I do, Joe. Oh, you
okay.
Ready?
Here we go.
Yes.
All right. You exercise a right reserved to citizens every time you, A, speak your mind, B, get a fair trial, C, receive equal protection of the laws, or D, vote in public elections.
Oh, okay. So this, we're looking for something that is reserved to citizens of the United States. Oh, this is interesting. Okay. And could we have those choices one by one? And Joe, why don't you talk about each one of them as they come up? What is it again?
Sure thing. You exercise a right reserved to citizens every time you, A, speak your mind.
Speak my mind. Okay.
Is that something only citizens have a right to do?
Well, I'm just going to put it to the side. You know, we'll consider that one.
I'm just going to tell those aliens to shut up for a minute while we consider these other questions. All right. Well, what's B then, Kelly?
B is get a fair trial.
Do only citizens get a fair trial?
No, I think everyone's entitled to that one.
Okay, so we're going to strike B off, or Joe is, I should say. Okay, what's C?
C is receive equal protection of the laws.
What about that? Do you have to be a citizen to be treated equally under the law?
Well, I'm thinking that might hurt our tourism trade. if we didn't treat everyone equally when they came over.
No, look, this is a show not about travel and tourism. Okay. This is a show about the Constitution.
Unless you're coming to visit James Madison's Mount Pilliard.
Okay,
then it's a show about travel.
Okay. Then it's about the Constitution. But this is a show about the Constitution. The question is, does the Constitution give equal protection only to citizens or to everyone?
What was that last one?
That was the last one.
No, the last one was vote in public elections.
Oh, you mean, okay, yeah, answer choice C is equal protection, answer choice D is...
Choice D is vote in public elections, answer choice C is receive equal protection of the laws.
All right, and we're looking for the one that's only reserved to citizens.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I feel like D is the most obvious one, and because only citizens can vote in elections. So
you sure about that?
I'm going to go with D as my final answer.
Ooh, he sounds very serious. Well, okay, Kelly, he says it's his final answer. Did Joe get it correct?
Joe, well done.
Hey, well done. And you did something there. That's a very good multiple choice question technique, and that is that even though you thought a couple of the answers, like equal protection, might have been appropriate, the best answer, the one that was clearly true, and it is clearly true, is that you have to be a citizen to vote. And the court's actually spoken about this. It's one of those things that's essential to the functioning of our democracy. And if being a citizen means anything, it's the right to participate in self-government. And if being a non-citizen means anything, it's, that the citizens can exclude them from the governing process. Now, in contrast, to go through some of the other answer choices, the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment specifically applies to any person. So that should set your mind to rest about that. Everybody is entitled to equal protection, regardless of whether they're citizens or not. Similarly, as you probably heard from the Guantanamo controversy, even if you're a non-citizen, you're entitled to certain procedural protections and a fair trial, at least to a certain degree. And then what was the other choice? Answer choice A?
Speak your mind.
Yeah, speak your mind.
He put that to the side, remember?
He put it to the side, and we told the aliens to shut up for a while, but now let's let them, they can talk. They can talk. Aliens have First Amendment rights as well. So, yes, you got it correct, and we're very pleased for you, and you get a T-shirt.
All right. Well,
nice job, Joe.
Nice job, Joe. Thanks for playing.
All right.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and I'm speaking with Professor Peter Irons about a case, a death penalty case, that originated in the tiny town of Luttrell, Tennessee. The case is called House versus Bell. And it involves a problem that's just all too common in death penalty cases, something called ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yeah, and it's just so sad to see this happening again and again. At any rate, to get back to this case, it sounds like that's what was happening here. He wasn't interviewing witnesses. He wasn't bringing them forward.
Right.
Well, please, continue.
And his cross-examination of the prosecution witnesses was it fell way below the standard of competence.
Ouch.
For example, Billy Ray Hensley, who said that he had seen Paul House from a distance of about 500 yards, coming up from this embankment.
500 yards?
500 yards.
Wait a second. A football field is 100 yards long. So
it's five football
fields. It's nighttime, and it's five football fields away. That was your eyewitness identification?
No, it wasn't nighttime. It was during the afternoon.
Oh, okay.
The day after.
This was daytime.
But at any rate,
it's still a long way away.
The point is that Billy Ray Hensley gave two totally inconsistent accounts to the police of where he was when he first saw Paul House. One was that he was rounding a corner 500 yards up the road, and caught up with him when he got down to where House was. The other is that House drove up in a car, was in a car, and that they met about the driveway of the Muncie's house, and that's the first time he saw him.
Wait a minute, so one identification was on foot 500 yards away, the other one was an identification in cars?
Yes, yeah.
Okay.
The trial lawyer didn't even exploit this inconsistency. And additionally,
this is the guy who's putting the finger on House.
That's right.
And he's got that level of inconsistency.
He was illiterate, and he couldn't read the statements that the police took down from him. And when he was cross-examined, he did say, well, when he was rounding the curve in his car up at the top of the road, he took a glance down the road and saw House for maybe 1 or 2 seconds. Now, I went to the murder scene and paced off that entire distance and looked down. And then I did some calculations with friends of mine who are mathematics skilled, which I'm not. And they said that the apparent height, that is the height that you see something from a distance, of a 6-foot-tall person at a distance of 500 yards would be 1 inch.
Good heavens.
1 inch. So what he saw was a person 1 inch tall.
And he was able to identify his facial features at that distance.
And a person's head, by the way, would be about 1/6 of an inch for 1 or 2 seconds.
Yeah.
So at any rate, this is the kind of, unfortunately, justice that prevails in many places.
That's astonishing. I mean, as a defense lawyer, that's exactly the kind of witness you want. I mean, you get them up on the stand and you tear them to pieces with that kind of inconsistency.
That's right.
Even without the inconsistency. Just the 500-yard ID, just the one-inch factor. I mean, you just tear them to pieces.
Chuck Burks never went into that. He never judged the distances, the apparent height, or anything like that. So when Steve Kissinger took over, he found his... He actually found two different groups of witnesses. One were friends of Little Hube, many of them childhood friends. He was in his early 30s at the time. Women who had grown up with him, gone to school with him, who testified that shortly before House was put on trial, Little Hube came to their trailer one night. They were having a little sort of party of neighbors and friends. Little Hube was drunk. And he started crying, bawling, saying that he was really sorry he'd killed his wife. They'd gotten into an argument, and he had smacked her, and she fell down and hit her head. And he was so scared that he dragged her out and dumped her body. He said that in front of two separate witnesses. He's never found them.
Okay, wait a second. Wait a second. This is the radio. People can't see my jaw gaping open here. This guy confessed. The husband, Little Hugh...
Confessed
to third parties
right.
to precisely the murder with enough detail in it to substantiate it, and the defense counsel never found these witnesses.
No.
And apparently they didn't come forward either.
And no, one of them, as a matter of fact, went to the sheriff's office the next day after this happened.
After the murder.
After the confession to tell the sheriff about it, and the sheriff said he was too busy to talk and sent her to a deputy who was too busy, and she finally gave up and left.
Did she ever actually tell anybody at the sheriff's office about this, or just did she never?
Yes.
She did tell
them. But she said she wanted to tell them about a confession by Little Hube, and they didn't want to hear it. So,
Wait a second. Now I have to say something else here. That, even that, is what we call Brady material.
That's exactly right.
Right, and there's a very famous case, the Brady case, that says if the police, if the prosecutor have any exculpatory evidence, anything that tends to cast doubt on the guilt of the defendant, they have to give that evidence to the defense counsel, because the job of the prosecutor is not to get a conviction, it's to do justice.
Right.
And they, of course, never mention this?
They never mention this. They also never mentioned these are all things that Steve Kissinger found out during the habeas proceedings.
Right.
He had five witnesses who testified to either hearing Little Hube's confession, seeing Little Hube on the night of the murder smack his wife, Little Hube coming over 6 o'clock in the morning before her body was found, which was around 2 p.m, to ask one of his friends to give him an alibi for the night before, saying that he had been at the square dance until midnight, and she hadn't.
We've got evidence that he's soliciting alibis.
That's right.
Oh, geez.
So Kissinger got all of this together.
Right.
And he also found two scientific witnesses. One, the most important, Dr. Cleland Blake, was the assistant medical examiner for the state of Tennessee, who had performed 5,000 autopsies. He almost always testified for the prosecution. But he reviewed the reports of the FBI technician on the blood that was found on his jeans and the blood that was in the vials from the autopsy, one of which had been totally drained of blood, even though the FBI technician said he only used a few drops.
Hmm.
Where did it go? Nobody knew. But at any rate, Dr. Blake testified that there was no possibility, because of his analysis of enzymes and enzyme breakdown, which is complicated, and juries don't understand that stuff.
Right.
There was no possibility that the blood on his jeans had come from Carolyn Muncy while she was still alive. It had been placed on his jeans somehow after she had died.
Oh, boy. Oh, my goodness. Did they actually plant that blood on those jeans?
Well, there's no direct evidence, but that's a fairly good supposition.
Oh, good heavens.
either the deputy sheriff or the FBI technician or somebody.
Well, I don't know if the FBI would have any motive here, but it sounds like the sheriff.
Well, the FBI has recently, Stuart, been involved in numerous examples of misconduct in their forensic analysis. Dr. Blake's conclusion was that the vials of blood, which were in this cardboard box along with House's jeans, the vials of blood, because of the heat in the trunk, there was no air conditioning, it was 90 degrees, that the stoppers had popped out.
Right.
And blood had spilled onto the jeans.
Oh, okay, so it could have just been incompetence.
That's right.
They stuck them all in the same box?
All in the same box.
Excuse me, I'm sorry now. They take all the evidence, and the whole point of this is to analyze whether the blood in the vials and the blood in the jeans is the same, and they put them in the same box and jostle them around for hours.
For 12 hours.
They well, drove. Maybe it wasn't a frame-up in that regard. Maybe it was just incompetence again.
They drove all the way from Tennessee to Washington, D.C. at night in the middle of the summer. So, at any rate, Steve Kissinger's other primary witness, scientific witness, was a DNA expert who testified that the semen on Carolyn Muncie's panties and nightgown did not come from House. It came from her husband.
Wow.
And the police had a interview report with Muncie the day after the murder, in which he admitted having sex with his wife that morning.
Little Hube.
Little Hube
okay.
did. That was never turned over to the defense. Nor were numerous other documents that would have been exculpatory, as you explain. So what happened was they had this three-day hearing before Judge Jarvis. Judge Jarvis took a year, wrote a 50-page opinion in which he turned down every single one of the habeas allegations.
Whoa. They're in federal court, and the federal judge in Knoxville takes a year to evaluate this and rejects all of these?
Rejects all of them.
It's your weekly Constitutional, and I'm discussing some very important issues, things like habeas corpus and ineffective assistance of counsel, things that crop up frequently in death penalty cases, and I'm talking about them with Professor Peter Irons, an expert on the subject. Let's take a moment now and do our Madison Minute, and then after the break and an update on what's happening at Montpelier, we'll come back and finish our discussion with Professor Peter Irons. Stay tuned.
In 1804, the Madisons began collecting portraits of the presidents, beginning with one of George Washington and also one of Thomas Jefferson, under whom James was then serving as Secretary of State. By the early 1820s, they had also acquired portraits of John Adams, our second president, and James Monroe, our fifth. Many visitors to Montpelier noted that these portraits were displayed in the drawing room at Montpelier, including one visitor who observed that they were all hanging together in a corner of the room. Notably, the Madisons chose not to hang James's portrait in this presidential grouping. They instead hung it next to a portrait of Dolly on the opposite wall. Perhaps suggesting a degree of humility, this choice most certainly indicates the Madisons' wish to be presented alongside one another to their many guests. With a Madison Minute, I'm Jim Blalock.
Time to find out what's happening this week at Montpelier, but just to mix things up a bit, I'm not going to talk to Kelly this week. I'm going to talk to Christian Coates at Montpelier, who's a director of education and visitor engagement, and he's going to tell us all about a brand new exhibit at Montpelier.
Well, you know, we've got the War of 1812 exhibit coming up.
Tell me all about that.
Oh,
yeah, it's
well,
2012.
That's
I mean,
right.
If the world doesn't come to an end, then over the next couple of years, we're going to be
right.
commemorating the War of 1812. What are you going to do about that?
Well, we've got a big exhibit coming in to the second floor of the mansion and into room 118, which is the wing, the Constitution room, we call it. And
when will that happen?
Well, actually, the exhibit opens on the day we declare war. So on the 18th
of June.
On the 18th of June.
So that's coming up
next Monday.
That's a week from today. Okay,
that's
good.
Right. Yeah. And there'll be a number of other historic sites around the country who will be doing exhibits on the War of 1812 because it's the bicentennial. But we thought we could do something a little different because, you know, there are a lot of military sites that are going to try to tell the story of the war or of particular battles, but we're really the only place that's going to be able to do it from the president's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we focused on a lot of trying to explain a little bit of the bigger picture. It's an often oversimplified conflict, and it really had a lot of there were a lot of different reasons behind the war, you know. And so we try to talk about those. You know, you have everything from the American Indians in the West who are attacking American settlers, but are also acting in Britain's interest, although they really weren't technically acting for Britain.
Mm-hmm.
You have the impressment of American sailors on the high seas by both Britain and France. You have the seizure of neutral American shipping on the high seas by both Britain and France. You have just a group of people in Congress, a bunch of young Southern Western guys who kind of want to go to war.
Thanks to Christian Coates of Montpelier for telling us about that fascinating new exhibit. I want to see that one. I'm going back and I'm going to see that 1812 exhibit at Montpelier. That just sounds fascinating. Well, now it's time to resume our discussion with Professor Peter Irons. We're talking about the death penalty and we're talking about habeas corpus, all in the context of the case of House versus Bell, which originated in a tiny little town in northeast Tennessee. We've just reached the point where the case has gone before a federal judge, and now it's going to go on appeal to the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati, Ohio.
And so they appealed, Kissinger appealed to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit in Cincinnati.
Mm-hmm.
And it was heard en banc, which means all of the active judges.
Like 20
on the court. Right? There were 15 at the time.
15. It's still a lot of judges in a courtroom.
That's a lot of judges. And they ruled 8-7 to uphold Judge Jarvis's dismissal of the habeas petition. But
how could this be?
How could this be? Well, as the dissenting judge, Gilbert Merritt, pointed out, the 8 judges in the majority, all of whom had been appointed, by the way, by Republican presidents.
Uh-huh.
All 7 of those in dissent had been appointed by Democratic presidents.
Wow.
So make your own conclusion from that. But at any rate...
But look, I mean, whatever side of the political divide someone's on, I mean, you know, Republicans have got to care about due process and they've got to care about justice as well, at least in a case like this where the evidence is so overwhelming. Was that all it was? Is simply Kissinger, the federal defender, going in and saying, look, there are all these irregularities, we need to go back. What basis upon did the Sixth Circuit use to uphold this? Were they simply being deferential to the judge and saying he heard the evidence and we didn't?
Entirely. They said the judge heard the evidence, he judged the credibility of the witnesses and decided that the witnesses to Hubert's confession, and also Dr. Blake, the noted forensic expert for the state of Tennessee, were not credible witnesses.
So it really kind of goes back on Judge Jarvis, and did he really just disbelieve all of these witnesses?
He was predisposed toward the prosecution. That was clear. But... the interesting thing is that Kissinger appealed that 8-7 loss to the Supreme Court. Now, the Supreme Court will often take cases where a court of appeals, either state or federal court of appeals or Supreme Court, has been almost evenly divided on a very important issue. And so they took the case.
Okay, that is extraordinary. That would have been it. This would have been the defendant's last gasp.
That's right.
The Sixth Circuit. So,
right.
I mean, they must have been ecstatic when the Supreme Court granted cert.
Yeah. Now, of course, by this time, Stuart, this was in 2006 when the Supreme Court took the case.
It's been 20 years.
Paul House had been on death row for 20 years. Already. He had developed multiple sclerosis. He had to sit in a wheelchair. He couldn't feed himself. And so the Supreme Court ruled 5-3.
Wait a second. Before we get there,
Yeah.
How does the Supreme Court decide whether to grant cert or not?
Well, it obviously felt that this was a case where the facts were so much in contention, and presumably, having read the opinions of the Court of Appeals, was not impressed with the majority opinion.
Okay, now in the court you have nine justices, and then typically they follow something called a rule of four, right?
That's right.
So essentially, if I want cert, if I want the court to grant cert, and that's called certiorari, or it's pronounced in a couple of ways, Latin term, we say simply cert. If we want them to grant cert, I've got to convince four out of those nine to say this is a case worthy of our consideration.
That's right.
So they were able to do that, and that's generally considered a great victory, just to get that level of attention. So now they're going to hear this case, they're going to review this factual case, which is
right.
extraordinary for them, because they're generally concerned with matters of law, and typically constitutional law. And now, there are lots of constitutional due process type issues in here, right. but it's basically a factual inquiry.
And the interesting thing, Stuart, about the oral arguments before the Supreme Court was that 80% of the questions had to do with the facts surrounding the blood and the eyewitness identification.
That is remarkable in the U.S. Supreme Court.
For example, Justice Scalia, who asked questions in a very prosecutorial manner, of Steve Kissinger, asked 18 consecutive questions about why shouldn't we just defer to what Judge Jarvis found in the Sixth Circuit. Justice Breyer asked the state attorney 22 questions about the blood. Where had the blood come from? How could she explain Dr. Blake's testimony? And at the end of it, the court ruled 5-3, one justice didn't, Justice O'Connor had just retired, Justice Alito had just taken her place and didn't participate.
Okay.
Ruled 5-3, the majority opinion written by Justice Kennedy, that the Court of Appeals should be reversed and the case sent back to federal court in Knoxville for another hearing to examine whether House met the standard, it's called the gateway standard, mm-hmm. to a new hearing on the basis of newly discovered evidence that would tend to exculpate him. Fortunately for Kissinger and House, and unfortunately for Judge Jarvis died just before this hearing was scheduled.
Okay, so the Supreme Court says we're reversing the Sixth Circuit, we're sending, it's called a remand, we're remanding this down all the way back to the federal court, and we're basically ordering the federal court to reconsider.
And what happened then was that a judge was appointed, Judge Harry Matisse, known as Sandy mm-hmm. Matisse, and he turned out, although he was known as a fairly conservative law and order judge, he looked at the record again and made a ruling on the habeas corpus petition, granting what was called a conditional writ of habeas corpus, which means, and he ruled that Chuck Burks had not properly identified potential witnesses, particularly the ones who heard Little Hube's confession, that the state had withheld the evidence about the semen coming from Little Hube and not from Paul House, about the blood not being properly handled during its transit, and a few other issues. Mm-hmm. Fairly narrow, but he said this warranted a new trial. And he gave the state of Tennessee 180 days to either begin a new trial or dismiss the charges.
Okay, then again, we have to stop here. So the remedy after all of this, after more than 20 years, is this guy gets a new trial. Okay, so he is still in jeopardy. He is still possibly going to be convicted and possibly going to be executed,
right.
but at least he's going to get a second bite at the apple.
Plus, in the second trial, all the new evidence
right.
that
all this
came
stuff
up
is
at the habeas
corpus right.
would be admitted.
Right.
And the Supreme Court ruled that what it said, quote, no reasonable juror, knowing both the new and the old evidence, would be likely to vote to convict Paul House.
Okay, so the court has given that much of an indication of how it thinks this case should end.
That's right.
So even though we've got an order for, you know, a remand, and then ultimately an order for a new trial, the grant, the conditional grant of habeas, Everybody's fully expecting that the prosecution is going to do what? It's not going to try him again?
The prosecution vowed that it was going to try him again.
No way! The Tennessee prosecutor is going to try this case again.
And it's the same district attorney that prosecuted Paul House in the first place in 1985, a guy named Paul Phillips. And he said, we are going to try this case again. And the after Judge Matisse issued his conditional writ, the state attorney general appealed that to the Sixth Circuit. And for months, there were motions going back and forth and arguments before the Sixth Circuit and also before Judge Matisse on whether they should proceed with a new trial. Kissinger was arguing that it should be an unconditional writ and the charges dismissed because the evidence of his innocence was incontrovertible, or at least there was more than reasonable doubt.
Yeah, that's the standard. I mean, the prosecution bears all the burden in a criminal case. Yeah, okay.
So what finally happened was they did some new DNA testing on other pieces of evidence, some hairs, head hairs that were found in Carolyn's hand at the time of her autopsy, some cigarette butts that were found at the scene, and scrapings from under her fingernails, which Paul Phillips said would conclusively show that Paul House was, in fact, the perpetrator.
Right.
Well, they did the DNA testing.
And this is all in 2000? This
is in 2008.
Okay, so now we've got some pretty good DNA stuff.
Right.
About technology.
Right.
Okay, so, okay.
And the DNA lab, in fact, I was the one who recommended that particular lab. I was helping Steve Kissinger on the case, strictly pro bono, concluded that it didn't match, none of this matched Paul House. There was no forensic evidence tying him to the crime. And the blood evidence on the genes had been thoroughly discredited. So, but they tried to drag it out as long as they could. And finally, the state Supreme Court appointed a retired state judge from Memphis to come over to Knoxville and hold a hearing.
That's about as far away in the state of Tennessee as you can get. Okay.
So opposite side.
He's not part of the hometown crowd.
No, he's not. And he said that they had used up their 180 days to hold a new trial, and that he was going to release House on bond, and he gave the state an extra 30 days to decide whether to hold a new trial. Release him on bond to the custody of his mother, considering, of course, that he was in a wheelchair.
Right.
And the state objected to that on the grounds that he posed a flight risk. And a danger to the community.
I'm sorry, I'm not... That okay, go on, please.
Well, finally, the district attorney, Paul Phillips, came into court and said, we are going to dismiss the charges. On the ground that Mr. House is in poor health, and that he served enough time, and we still think he's guilty.
Wow. So even at this late stage, even as they're effectively giving up, they're not willing to admit that this guy, they didn't have the evidence to convict
him. That's right.
Now, wait a second. Did they ever go after the husband? What about little Hugh? I mean, they've done the DNA testing under the fingernails. They've got the hairs. They've got everything. Did anyone go out and it was little Hugh still around?
Little Hugh is still around. Still professing his innocence and
has
saying
anyone
that
investigated
he grieves for his wife. Well, there's this late date, 25 years.
Oh, is there a statute of limitation? No, there's no statute of limitation.
No, not on murder, but what would he be convicted of? And the most serious charge you could imagine, given the paucity of evidence,
is
manslaughter. Now, the statute of limitations on manslaughter has expired. And he is never going to be charged. So, literally, this is a case in which the perpetrator got away with murder. Hmm. But an innocent man spent 22 years on death row for a crime he almost certainly did not commit.
And there are, as you know, hundreds probably of inmates in similar circumstances who simply don't have the legal resources or the sophisticated technology. Keep in mind that most of these cases of exoneration are not based on DNA evidence, but on eyewitness testimony that is often very faulty or untrue. Plus a lot of forensic misconduct by state and federal crime labs. Now that's, and Paul House has now been out of prison for 4 years, living with his mother. And he's reasonably comfortable considering that he has very little mobility. But it's just, the reason I chose this case, Stuart, for this book is that it illustrates in just one example, and I don't try to draw any huge broad conclusions, but it illustrates in one example how everything possible can go wrong in the criminal justice system without the oversight of really dedicated, impartial judges and prosecutors with integrity. Mm-hmm. Now, Paul House was lucky that he found Steve Kissinger. He was lucky that he found eventually Judge Matisse after Judge Jarvis died. He was lucky that he found Judge Merritt on the Sixth Circuit, who wrote a scathing dissent from the majority opinion. He was lucky that Justice Kennedy looked very, very carefully at the facts in the case. But not all of these defendants are so lucky. In fact, most of them are very unlucky.
Mm. Well, that is a tragic tale. It has a happy ending, but you know, one wonders how happy one can be after 22 years on death row. And, of course, in the intervening time, he's lost all that time. He's become very, very ill. He's not the man he used to be at all, and a very sad tale. And it illustrates very much the title of your book, All the Steps Heading Up to the Court, All the Steps Coming Down from the Court. A fascinating tale. And I'm reminded we didn't even get to the second case, and so we're going to have to talk about that some other time. But thank you so much, Professor Peter Irons, for sharing this remarkable tale with us. Any final thoughts?
Well, I'm glad to have been invited to your weekly constitutional. Mm-hmm. And I do, of course, feel very strongly that people in what we call the general public.
Yeah. And we're all members.
And we are.
We are all members.
Even us lawyers.
Yes.
Need to be reminded that the system, with all of its tremendous advantages in the Constitution, the protection, for example, of criminal defendants, is subject to human decision-making, discretion, and occasional error.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Professor Peter Irons, author of the new book, The Steps to the Supreme Court, from which this very compelling account was taken. Thanks also to our executive producer, Wayne Winkler. My name is Stuart Harris, and remember, it's your Constitution, and you need to learn all about it.